Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Republicans Doug O'Brien and Todd Stump, and Democrats Richard Boykin and Mark Casello. A program tonight coming from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications on State Street, that great street in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv. And remember, if you want to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. If you missed the show, the audio and video streaming of the show is available. We keep it for many, many months. So if you miss it, you can always find it at our website. Tonight, 2 hours of politics, national politics, rock'em sock'em spirited discussion. Two Republicans, two Democrats, sleeves rolled up. At least my sleeves are rolled up and they're ready to go. Obviously, a dominating factor of this past week has been the first week out of the box with Paul Ryan, the running mate for Mitt Romney, dominating a lot of the news, a lot of the rhetoric back and forth between the campaigns, heating up. And, of course, the statement of the vice president, Joe Biden, which, again, stirred a lot of things up when he perhaps stepped on it, at least was somewhat insensitive in a comment. Let's go to the comment about at hand. This was a discussion of Mitt Romney by Vice President Joe Biden. And he said, quote, he is going to let the big banks once again write their own rules. Unchain Wall Street. He's going to put you all back in chains. End of quote. Well, he was talking to a friendly group, but many in that group were African Americans, and the issue of whether that was racially insensitive really moved very quickly, not only on the blogosphere, but on mainstream media, and Joe Biden and the president found themselves sort of playing defense a little bit. Richard Boykin is with us this evening. He is the former chief of staff to Illinois Congressman Danny Davis, now a partner in Barnes & Thornburg. Richard, thanks very much for being with us. Nice to have you with us. What was your reaction to the comments by the vice president?
Well, I found the comments, Bruce, to be quite insensitive. I found them to be race baiting at its finest hour. I think that our politics has no place for that type of language. I think we've made great strides in terms of racial relations in this country, electing our first African-American president. We're still not a race-neutral society, of course, but, I mean, to inflame people just to try to pander and get votes is simply wrong.
Do you think that it was not just the words, it was sort of the way he said it?
Well, I didn't focus on the way that he said it. He was in Danville, Virginia. I mean, Virginia, of course, is a place that held slaves. I mean, the slaves came into Jamestown and that sort of thing. And so it's an insensitive thing to say. And I think that the president should not have defended his comments.
Doug O'Brien, by the way, that was our Democrat, our Republican Doug O'Brien this evening. Doug, former chief of staff to Mark Kirk in Congress, now the head of Prairie State Strategies. Your response, you're a political operative. Were you quick to jump on the vice president?
Joe Biden has repeatedly shown himself to be a weak link in this administration. On the campaign trail, I think he's going to continue to do so. But I think it goes back to one of the fundamental issues in this campaign, and that is that the Obama-Biden campaign is using every rhetorical device they can to change the subject, to try to raise issues, whether it is very thinly veiled racial innuendo, whether it is trying to change the subject away from anything about the administration's record. But, you know, Joe Biden goes out and to apparently everybody said, Joe's improvised. The administration, oh, that's just Joe. I mean, how many times do we have to hear this ridiculousness about, oh, that's just Joe, as if it's an excuse?
Mark Casello, Democrat, was it just Joe? Should we? Is this Republican crocodile tears?
Sure. Well, I think that Joe Biden is a deliberate weapon. You know, we can send him out
a blunt instrument, if you will.
If he can go out and say the things people can't, but what he was saying take the metaphor out of it. I think what's important is many Americans are shackled by debt. They're shackled to banks. They're shackled to credit card interest rates that are skyrocketing. And the American people are tired of it. And Joe Biden was trying to make that point.
But he didn't make it. He didn't make that point.
He totally decided to go
one step further to throw a grenade in the middle of the political debate. And that's the shameful thing.
He was
thing.
Too clever by half because he was trying to co-opt.
That was clever?
Well, he was trying to co-opt the Republican language of shackling the economy and the burden on the American business people. And he did it of an unfortunate choice of words. But I think the issue is if the Republicans get back into power, if you put Mitt Romney in power, you're going to see banks
running rampant. Unfortunate choice of words. You don't think they were the deliberate choice of words.
Yeah, I do not.
Seems to be some difference on that. Todd Stump also joins us. Welcome to Beyond the Beltway. First-time appearance. Businessman, go ahead. Your response.
Thank you. I think it's you don't do yourself any favors in terms of your own credibility when you deny that he didn't mean what he said. That was a very deliberate thing that he said. He was playing to an audience there and he thought he would ingratiate himself with the audience. And then when it happens, it's just Joe. Well, I think a lot of people are asking themselves right now, what if it becomes that's just President Joe? And that reflects very poorly on this president if this is the guy who's expected to take the reins if the unfortunate happens. And I don't think when you stand him next to someone like Congressman Ryan, who is a policy wonk and I think he's much more responsible and much more in touch with the details of governing, when you put them side by side, I think the choice is obvious.
Now, the Romney campaign did respond, and this is what they had to say. If we can put it up on the screen so I can remember exactly what they had to say. Here we go. They responded by saying, Obama's campaign and his surrogates have made wild and reckless accusations that disgrace the office of the presidency. Another outrageous charge came a few hours ago in Virginia, and the White House sinks a little bit lower. Mr. President, take your campaign of division and anger and hate back to Chicago. That was the big applause line. This is what an angry and desperate presidency looks like. President Obama knows better, promised better, and America deserves better. Richard, what was your response to the Romney response? Did he take it and push it a lot further down the road?
Look, I think that the American people deserve to have an honest debate about the direction of the country. And I think that both candidates would do themselves well to stay away from the sort of incendiary things like race baiting, like hateful speech and things like that.
Do you think that the campaign has been there? Is there? I mean, what Romney was saying is let's get it out of the gutter.
Right.
Do you think that it is? Does everyone agree that it is? Todd, do you agree it's in the gutter?
I think one side is deeper in the gutter than the other. And I think this is always the tendency when someone on the Democratic side, in this case Biden, makes an absolutely incendiary remark, as you call it, right? The response is, hey, both sides have to cool things down. This isn't a case in which both sides are fanning the flames. The Obama campaign does not have a record to run on, so that it is just smear after smear after smear and trivia after it's some kind of trivia after trivia after trivia. The dog on the car, the horses, the car elevator, etc., etc.
We've got to pause. 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border. I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us this evening. Richard Boykin, you were going to make a comment to what Todd was saying before the break.
Right. I was just going to say to my good friend that, look, I mean, I think that these campaigns, this is such a critical election. It's about the direction of our country and which way we'll go. I mean, when you do tit for tat or when you try to, you know, hit somebody because the vice president said something that was out of bounds, I mean, I don't think you do yourself any favors. I think that you have to elevate the discussion, talk about the issues, stay on the issues. I mean, if the other guy's going to get off sideways, then, I mean, look, focus on your campaign, focus on the issues.
I'm going to go back to what we talked about last week and also sort of broaden it beyond the comments of the vice president. Mark, what's your opinion of Paul Ryan?
of Paul Ryan. I thought he was a very calculated pick. I think he comes across, he's a policy wonk, as Todd described him. But if you look back at his record, he's voted for TARP. During the Bush administration, he was a good soldier for Bush, and he was part of that Congress that was responsible for the reckless spending that the Tea Party rose up against. He voted for the Bush stimulus in 2002, $120 billion. And he voted for both wars, which were unfunded and off the books. So it's good for him to come out. He talks a good game. He's articulate. He's going to connect well with some people. But I think Paul Ryan is not who he pretends to be.
Todd, you think you agree with that?
No, I think the gentlemen who have been on congressional staffs would know much better than I. But I think you take a lot of votes when you are a junior congressman that you don't necessarily agree with. And I'm sure he fought his corner within the delegation or within the caucus to get the bill looking like it should. But in the end, you know, he went along with his party. When he's in a position of power, I think it looks much different.
Doug, first of all, because you and Richard know Congressman Ryan, what sort of a guy is he?
He is absolutely the guy next door. He's a guy who grew up in Janesville, Wisconsin.
Because he's Wisconsin, you were in
almost, yeah, in a sense, in a broader sense, literally next door. But this is a guy who really, I think, people in the Midwest would find a tremendous amount in common with him. This is a guy who's grown up with a great value system instilled by his parents. His father passed away when he was young, but he's a guy who's been in public life and in public service for his whole career. He's got a tremendous depth of policy knowledge. But it's balanced out by his sort of common sense values and background. He really is a very regular guy. So it's a great pick in that sense. He's got a tremendous ability to connect with really the target voters, the families, the middle class families in middle class America.
Richard, again, you were chief of staff to Congressman Danny Davis, Democrat from Chicago. What was your relationship with Congressman Ryan and his office?
Well, I mean, we worked with him. Obviously, Congressman Davis worked with him on the Ways and Means Committee. But I find him to be, and Doug is absolutely spot on. He's an intellectual. He gets into the weeds of policy. I mean, he understands it very well. I think it's a breath of fresh air. I mean, look, I like him. I happen to like him as a person. I like the person that he is, and the fact that he's from a middle class.
Also, his background. He was a staffer as well.
Absolutely.
So he comes out of the same background as you two gentlemen.
So there's hope for Doug and I.
There is.
No, I'm just joking. No, but I'm really not joking about
but
that.
But are you
not for me,
Richard? last week on this show, when we had the Democrats, it was our first week after the announcement had made. The Democrats were both ecstatic. They thought this was absolutely the best pick. Everybody agreed last week. The Republicans thought it was the best pick. The Democrats liked it was the best pick because it's a real clear choice. Do you like it that way, Mark?
Sure.
Because we've talked about that on this program.
Mm-hmm.
You'd like an up or down vote on some of the things that you're involved in?
Absolutely. I think the big reason for Democrats that Paul Ryan is the pick is because of the status of Florida in the election. If Obama takes New Hampshire and Florida, he can clinch the election. And so Paul Ryan's stance on Medicare is really driving the Democratic liking of Paul Ryan.
It's not so much Paul Ryan's stance on Medicare, but it is the Democrats' ability to misrepresent Paul Ryan's stance on Medicare and demagogue it. And they've fired all the 16-inch guns. The salvos have been going for 7 days, and it has made really not one scintilla of difference thus far. What we've seen so far is that Paul Ryan has been able to hold his own and really focus this on a discussion of the particulars. And I think that is going to be beneficial. That's why Republicans really like this pick.
And I think it's unusual. We have been – the frustration with Romney, besides, you know, some of the policy, has been his inability to articulate our side. And that, I think, is Ryan's core strength.
And I think that Democrats are also giddy about the pick of Paul Ryan because they feel like, hey, it takes the spotlight off the economy, the focus off the economy, and we're talking entitlement issues. But from my standpoint, in my opinion, we got to talk entitlement reform, or else the country goes over the financial cliff. We don't make it. We can't fund these entitlement programs that are so vital to our senior citizens.
Well, it seems to me the other thing that it helps you with is, and certainly this is something that John McCain suffered, you know, badly 4 years ago, and that is, here's a candidate. This is the first and maybe the most important decision they're going to make. And you got to compare the reaction to, okay, I'm going to pick Sarah Palin because I think she's the most qualified person in America to be a heartbeat away.
Right.
And Romney, it's doubling down on his strength. In other words, I don't think he picked him because he might get 10 votes out of Wisconsin. I don't think he picked him because he was Catholic. I mean, he picked him because it doubles down on the message that he wants to deliver. We are the pros that can talk in depth about anything related to finances, whereas the other side's going to wait for the teleprompter to roll.
So I'd go back to the point about demagoguery. As you guys had seen, Paul Ryan drug his mom down to Florida. Maybe she went Wellingway. That was a misstatement there. But
Ryan drags mom.
She lives there. Okay. Line, right? So
behind Texas.
Yeah, ties her to the bumper.
That's right, yeah.
But if you want to talk about demagoguery, so he brings his mom out and he says,
Bringing your mom out's not demagoguery. Lying about facts is demagoguery.
So he brings his mom out, and what she is, she's a museum piece to the American public to say, this is the last generation that's going to have Medicare as we know it. That's demagoguery.
No, what that is actually is that is truth, because in 12 years, the Medicare Trust Fund will be bankrupt. That is a fact according to the trustees.
Okay.
Now, let me finish. Mm-hmm. If we follow the path of do nothing and simply shift money from the Medicare Trust Fund to pay for more beneficiaries and more government-run health care, that's not going to help Medicare stay solvent. It is going to exacerbate the problem. We have an unsustainable program right now, and the Obama administration is making it worse every second of every day.
So the straw man argument of do nothing, no one is saying that. The Obama administration's not doing that. But for example,
they've promised to preserve Medicare exactly as it is.
Excuse me, Mark, can I ask you a question? You just said that the do nothing argument is a straw man. Was it a straw man when the Democrats used it against Republicans on the health care issue?
No, and I called it out. Obama is the master of the straw man. But
Okay. Thank you.
But the point is that Paul Ryan, for example, wants to eliminate, in his budget, he proposed eliminating all capital gains taxes, all investment taxes, the inheritance tax. And that doesn't seem fiscally responsible if you want to help bolster.
Unless you understand
Medicare.
What that actually does in the economy and
sure.
what Democrats enriches the 1%
more than they are.
Absolutely. But what it also does, because you're not paying attention to facts, you're paying attention to rhetoric, what it does, as we saw in black and white, when President Reagan reduced the capital gains tax, it increased capital gains revenues to the government exponentially. That is simply a fact of economics and something that Democrats desire to ignore.
0% capital gains cannot increase tax revenues. And that's Paul Ryan's plan.
It increases economic activity.
We're going to go to calls. Charlotte in Arlington Heights, Illinois. You're on 89 WLS and Coast to Coast.
Do you think Paul Ryan now will get the youth vote? I mean, he's the first candidate running for this high office from the decade of the 1970s, born in 1970, compared to Barack Obama now, who's what, 49, 50? What was his birthday?
52.
I don't know. I didn't see it on the birth certificate.
He's ancient.
I was listening to an interview with Governor Walker of Wisconsin. He and Paul would flip hamburgers together at McDonald's, a summer job or part-time job. Can you imagine Al Gore or John Kerry doing this? Are they the men of the people?
Well, let's talk about some of the other things, because, again, although the policy wonks of the people around this table, again, you know, I think you make up the, you know, the 95% of people that have already, you know, decided where you're going to go. But the stylistic things, the personality things that really get, you know, that can move needles and cause the difference between victory and defeat, it seems to me that sort of on a visceral level, Paul Ryan has a lot going for him.
The saddest part of this, of the nomination of Paul Ryan, is that for the first time we have a vice presidential nominee younger than me.
Exactly. Yes,
that's
exactly how I feel.
And the flip side, and I think it ties into Social Security. The flip side of the Social Security and Medicare argument is that young people don't believe for a second it's going to be around there when it comes when they become 65. So even
so,
if
isn't that the real strength that he's bringing to the ticket? That he is really standing up for his generation. He doesn't want to throw grandma off the cliff, even though there's commercials that say that. He doesn't want to throw grandma off the cliff, so he wants to calm them down.
It's not
so they don't go anywhere. But he's basically standing up for the 40-somethings.
And the numbers are showing that his support among youth, the ticket's support among youth, is growing, and there's no evidence yet that his support among seniors is degrading.
All right, well, let's come back and talk about that when we return. 1-800-723-8289. Lots of callers on the line, but there is room for you. 1-800-723-8289. Coast to coast and border to border, live every Sunday night. I'm Bruce Dumont. From Tarzana, California to Tuscaloosa, Alabama, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us tonight on America's great radio stations, as well as Sirius and XM satellite radio. Our Democrats tonight, Mark Casella is here. He is an assistant professor of English at Calumet College of St. Joseph's. He also writes for the Huffington Post. And your current post is about what topic?
It's called The Unlovables, Romney Ryan 2012, and it looks at the Ryan pick and the likability of Paul Ryan and Mitt Romney.
Okay, we'll explain that as the next 2 hours continues. Also joining us this evening is Doug O'Brien. He is a former chief of staff to Illinois Congressman Mark Kirk, longtime Republican political operative, and also is the head of Prairie State Strategies, which is a strategy group not exclusively in politics. You do public affairs, a variety of other things.
Absolutely.
Any client that will pay, you'll work for them.
Well,
pretty much. Just a mercenary. Yeah.
You seem to have me confused with the advertising industry.
Also joining us is an old friend of this program, Richard Boykin. He was the chief of staff to Illinois Congressman Danny K. Davis for many, many years. He is a minister, and also he is a partner at Barnes & Thornburg, one of the country's leading law firms. Also joining us this evening is Todd Stump. Todd Stump is a businessman in the Chicagoland area. He was the campaign manager for Dan Proft when he ran for the Republican nomination for governor, and he's with an organization, a member of the board of America's Future Foundation. And in 50 words or less, what is the goal of that organization?
To develop new classical liberal leaders in Chicago, and we now have chapters across the nation as well.
Classical liberals in respect?
People who believe in the true meaning of the word liberal, and that is free minds and free markets.
Okay. Let's go to Raul, listening to us in Benton Harbor, Michigan, on our flagship station, WLS. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you. Al Gore, John Kerry, and Fighting Joe Biden's sons all served in the military. Joe Biden's son is still serving right now, I believe, as a captain in Afghanistan. And what Joe Biden said, first, I believe, I don't think anything does not get run by the president first, and he spoke the truth, not metaphorically, but the truth. When you want to disenfranchise millions of voters in this country, that's putting chains back on them, plain and simple. When you want to take away their economic freedom, that's putting chains back on them. He spoke the truth, and everybody knows it, and the president stood up for Fighting Joe.
Well, let's let our guest respond to it. Richard Boykin joins us, and he offered a different perspective, but he's going to tell you why he thinks you're wrong.
Well, I want to appreciate the caller for his perspective, but let me just say that to suggest that, you know, if you elect Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan, that they're going to put you all back in chains, I mean, that's strictly... that's going at slavery. I mean, that's what he's saying. Now, let me tell you this, what I believe, if I would have been those guys, I would have responded that there's so many people already in chains because they got invisible chains on their mind. And it's a lock, if you will. Too many people are addicted to government subsidies. Too many people are addicted to handouts and that sort of thing. And so if anybody, I mean, wants to talk about invisible chains, I mean, it ought to be somebody saying, hey, wait a minute, let's not addict people to government. Let's free people. liberation. That's what people need. People need to harness their entrepreneurial spirit and be creative in this country.
We have room on this side of the table, I think.
But in discussions of just historically in the county of Cook, which surrounds Chicago, where we do this program from, I mean, the Republicans have referred for many years when they talk about politics, is they view that there's a lot of African-American leaders who want to keep their people, their constituents, on the plantation, and that the local Democratic Party has been run like a plantation.
Well, you've
heard that rhetoric. I know you're nodding your head. I think you agree with that rhetoric.
Yeah, let me say that, I mean, you know, when we look at the state of Illinois, obviously, we had a special session on Friday. We had an $83 billion pension hole that needs to be taken care of. Quite frankly, most of the people down there in Springfield, the elected officials, have let down the public. I mean, in a number of ways. $12.6 million a day is what it's costing us every day that we don't solve this pension crisis. Illinois is not too dissimilar from a number of other states. And also, I'll say this about being on a plantation or plantation-style politics. Anytime you got 89% of the violence being perpetrated, killings and shootings in Chicago and black communities, and none of the black leaders are stepping forward to do something about it, not even the white leaders are stepping forward to do something about it, it's a crime. It's criminal. It's not equal protection under the law.
Is there something? I hinted this a couple of weeks ago, and I just want to divert from our conversation because I think we're onto something here. I said that at that particular time, as the president of the United States, maybe Barack Obama should take a couple of days off, come back to his hometown and say something, do something, bring the bully pulpit of the presidency to the scandalous violence that is occurring on the south and west sides of this city, including his former senatorial district.
Bruce, you're exactly right. Look, there were 30 shootings over the weekend, 2.5 days period this weekend, 30. I mean, 6 people killed, mainly black-on-black crime. Look, I mean, you can look at a number of reasons why unemployment, high unemployment in the black community, that sort of thing, lack of parenting, that sort of thing. But the reality of it is that you got to have the leaders, people who are paid. These public officials are paid. They don't do this job for free. They have to get their hands dirty. They have to get involved at the community level. And they have to begin to bring some ideas and some solutions to the table.
Would that be too much of a gamble for the president of the United States? Would it be viewed as too parochial? I mean, the people in Chicago, obviously, a lot of politicians don't spend a lot of time in Chicago because they think Illinois is going to be, you know, lock solid in the Obama camp. They come to Chicago to raise money. Mitt Romney was here literally right next door from where we do this broadcast last week, actually for a couple of times. So people come to Chicago. There's not a lot of ad money that's spent here. I mean, is that a Pollyannish view of what a president could do to at least address a real serious issue that really does have national implications?
I actually think that for the president, it could be somewhat akin to Bill Clinton's sister soldier moment, where he said, where he really stood up and dove into something that was very much a topic of discussion more on the left, and took a position that was not necessarily going to be very popular among the far left. But, you know, the president, obviously, the fact that it polls well and it tests well to, say, Chicago-style politics, because, frankly, embarrassed though I am as a Chicago resident about that image, it very much is true. And the fact that the Romney campaign, the Republicans are talking about that, shows that it has traction. But to come back and say, look, I'm going to take a stand on something that is critically important in the community from which I came, but also an issue that shows to middle America, shows to independent voters that I'm not just pandering to my constituency on the left side of the spectrum.
Pandering to you.
Well, no, but I think, frankly, this is someplace where the president, through his leadership, could really plant a flag and really send a message to leaders in the community across the board, both in the communities on the south and west side, but throughout Illinois and throughout the country.
Mark, do you agree with that?
You know, I live a block from President Obama's house. I was in Woodlawn neighborhood, about 10 blocks south of Obama. Two young men came into a coffee shop, walked up, and stole a bunch of items off of a person's table right in the middle of the day. These are young people in these neighborhoods who don't have jobs. They don't have opportunities. President Obama, several times, he could have had the opportunity. When he first became elected, I had hoped he'd come out and talk about Detroit, talk about Chicago, talk about Gary, Indiana, as being in a state of emergency and push federal transportation dollars into these communities to either bring jobs to the people or people to the jobs. But it didn't happen. And here in Chicago, you have Rahm Emanuel, President Obama's former chief of staff. And in Chicago, there's a policy of sort of ignoring those communities. And it's been ongoing, and people don't want to talk about it.
But certainly for the mayor, not ignoring the violence, certainly with his indignation. I mean, he has been in some of the marches, the neighborhood marches. I don't think he has been as benign as I know.
Well, take
Rich Daley apart.
It goes to Richard's point, because I think the police commissioner here, the mayor, I think mayors throughout the country. First off, most of these large cities, like cities everywhere in this country, have financially mismanaged themselves to the point where they don't have a lot of the financial resources. But what Richard is talking about is really critical. It's the leadership resources that are completely lacking. And I think that the president's not going to come in and start doing neighborhood watch, but his leadership could go a huge way to incentivizing leaders at the grassroots level, at the community level, to really step
also,
up and take more responsibility.
Also, what happened 4 years ago when he was running against Hillary Clinton, it didn't happen a lot, but it happened periodically during the campaign. And it was when Barack Obama was basically talking to parents, black parents, yeah, about their responsibilities, yep, about what are you watching your children? Are you doing cultural things? I think, frankly, that's one of the reasons why Barack Obama became popular in some conservative.
That was the postpartisan rhetoric.
Rural, but right. Suburban areas. Mm-hmm. So I'm not so sure that by tackling this issue that is so ripping apart his base, that it would not. I mean, I'm not thinking about doing it for good politics. This is something that Barack Obama can still do while he is still president, that could make him a lasting positive effect for all of those who reside in big cities, not just Chicago. Back shortly. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. We will go to calls in just a moment, but Todd, you wanted to pick up on something that was said before the break.
I did. I think I'm alone on the panel here, in my opinion, that it may be good political strategy to come up there and do essentially like an NAAC bank shop that they accused Romney of, and that is going there, you're not talking to the crowd, you're talking to the white suburban audience. And what you mentioned explicitly is you go into these neighborhoods, you make a stand, you make a lot of statements, you generate some excitement among the leaders, and then you leave. And that, you said, would enhance his position within white suburbia. Right, that's great. Maybe great politics, but it does nothing to save one life in those neighborhoods. Nothing.
Let me just add one thing, okay, and then I'll give you the last word. Mm-hmm. I didn't mean to suggest that that was the principal reason why you would go there. I would say that the principal reason you're going there is there's outrageous things happening in the city that you once represented as a member of Congress, as a United States senator, and you are an African American. I mean, you inspired millions of African Americans because they aspired with you, they were inspired by you, and they aspired you, and they moved you along. And I'm just saying is that at this particular point, In their daily lives, they are living a life of they're being terrorized in those communities, and it would be nice if the president of the United States brought the bully pulpit of the presidency together.
It wouldn't be nice, though. This is what I'm trying to say. It would be nice for him politically. You know, that's a very good reason for doing it. What you just said, right? My grandfather.
By the way, I don't just mean politically. I mean morally.
I know you mean morally, right? As my grandfather used to tell me, there are two reasons for everything, a good reason and a real reason. Now, from your point of view, the real reason is to get down there, right, and solve this problem. A politician looks at it, the real reason is to get himself reelected. Now, I'd like to bring this back to the messaging aspect of this, right? Now, Mark, you justified Biden's chains remark by saying, oh, it was metaphorical, it was this, that, and the other thing. Kids are getting shot like crazy in this city. It's a slaughter going on, and they're almost all black or Latino kids, right? Okay? And also, the first thing that this administration did when they came in was they cut off the first thing, right, is they got rid of a scholarship program so that poor African-American kids could go to private school. Now, would the Republicans be justified in saying it's because they're racist? They don't. They hate poor kids. They hate African-American kids. They hate Hispanic kids. And that's why they do this. The language is no different. Right? Yeah. They want to send these kids to school. Now, we wouldn't say that. I don't believe it. I think your policies are misguided. But isn't that the same type of same use of language that you justified earlier?
Well, I'm going to evade for a second and say that the bigger issue is that we have a political system that's disconnected from these real issues. And our current conversation isn't engaging this. You're not going to hear this topic brought up in the national debate. So that's the bigger problem, and that's where you saw a lot of the energy of the Occupy movement that's still out there in these communities. For example, Southside Together Organizing for Power here in Chicago has been marching. Father Flager's been on the radio pushing for gun regulations here. These are local figures here in Chicago. But the bigger issue is that the American public doesn't care. There was an air show here in Chicago, the 53rd annual air show, and 3 million people came out. And those people are oblivious. They could care less about what's happening on the south side of Chicago.
That's
an overstatement.
These people are allowed to live their lives?
People in America want to live fat, insular lives where they don't go outside their bubble, their comfort zone, to help other people.
Well, when you start by vilifying the entire electorate with that broad brush, you are engaging in the kind of rhetoric that is hurting the Obama campaign. It is about divisiveness. It is about dividing the country. Richard's point that really struck a chord with me is that I believe, and you're absolutely right in terms of some of the policy issues, and we keep getting back and forth, well, you cut this and you cut that and you did this and you did that. But we're taught, and Bruce, you said it too, it is about this leadership void that we have. And it is about people, regardless of the cycle, the election cycle, regardless of the calculus. And I think in this instance, there's a good calculus. It's not necessarily a good idea to get off the larger 80% issues. But for the president to use his leadership to do something that I believe he has not done, and that is use the presidency to soar higher than the partisan rhetoric, and to really take a stand on this violence that is really destroying a lot of communities. It's a great opportunity.
Bruce, I just want to say this because Doug is right on. I think that this violence that's taking place in our inner cities, it's not just Chicago, Los Angeles, Detroit,
right,
it's other big cities, is a threat to our national security. Mm-hmm. And I'll simply say this.
I agree.
And I'll simply say this, that Pastor Niemöller had it right when he said, they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak up because I was not Jewish. They came for the communists, and I said nothing because I wasn't a communist. They came for the trade unionists. I didn't say anything because I wasn't a trade unionist. Then they came for me, and there was no one else left to speak up because everybody was gone. And so that is what's happening and akin in the black community, the Latino community. We have to show leadership. And I will tell you, I encourage Governor Romney and Congressman Ryan, speak to the issue of violence in the inner city. It's an important issue, and figure out a way, figure out a strategy. It's not partisan. It's not political. It's about lives and saving lives.
Well, I think I would hope that they would do that. And as I've said a number of times, for the last couple of months on this program, when we've talked even more than just a couple of months ago, I think that really it's something that the president should do. And again, people are going to say, "Well, he's coming back because he's fearful of spending too much time talking about perceived black issues." When the reality, this isn't just a black issue. This is a civility issue of living in a major city, and he is in a unique position because of his rhetorical skills, because of the pedestal that he is on. If after 4 years the violence in his hometown continues to grow, then I think he has really missed a significant opportunity as a moral leader to really do something to make life in America better for everyone, not just those who are really trapped in the South Side and West Side homes of Chicago. Anyway, that's my two cents. 1-800-723-8289. We'll be back for another full hour on radio, and we're also going to keep our conversation rolling. And for those watching us on television, we'll see you next week. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Republicans Doug O'Brien and Todd Stump, and Democrats Richard Boykin and Mark Casello. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. And in this hour of our broadcast, we are going to continue our discussion to a suggestion that I had in our first hour, and that is, what would happen if President Obama, or not what would happen, I sort of urged President Obama maybe to come back and spend some time in his own hometown and address the issue of rampant violence that we have. Now, if you're listening around the country, we're not trying to turn this into a Chicago-only discussion, but I do think there's an opportunity for the President of the United States to speak out about some of the rampant crime that exists, where people are killing each other and shooting each other. It's parts of Chicago are a shooting gallery. It is a disgrace, and as the leader of the free world and as someone who has the bully pulpit, I think he can bring the attention to that. We have a lot of callers on the line at 1-800-723-8289. We'll go to those calls in just a moment, but I do want to re-engage just for those that may have just tuned in. Mark Casello, you're one of our Democrats. I wanted to get your response to whether the idea would have any benefit by bringing the bully pulpit of the presidency to an issue like this.
Sure. Well, I think it's a very complicated issue. Earlier you said, you know, President Obama could use the bully pulpit and keep some of the issues that are under his purview or policy positions and sort of hit hammer on those, whether it's education. I think that could work. But it's a very complicated issue. There's a culture in our society that's training young people not to buy into the American system. And so you have a lack of opportunity. That lack of opportunity returns in the form of a cultural belief that this isn't my place. America's not for me. I'm not going to go to school. I'm not going to try to get a job. So you, on the one hand, you have sort of where the conservatives have a point, which is that there is some moral responsibility within a community to create a culture and to have leaders arise from that community. But there's also a systemic issue here that's underlying that the president could address. And it's not simply a gun control law or a transportation bill that's not going to fix it.
It's a respect for life. Richard Boykin,
exactly.
Former chief of staff to Congressman Danny Davis, West Side of Chicago, largely African American congressional district, not exclusively, but you are a leader in the African American community as well. You've spoken about these issues. What about what Mark just said about the cultural? Can the president lead a cultural discussion, and can that cultural discussion really get to the core of what needs to be done?
Bruce, let me say there's nothing complicated about the president doing this. He ought to do it. It's the right thing to do. I mean, people are dying. Chicago is like a war zone. I mean, you have more shootings per weekend when it's warm out than you have in Afghanistan or in Iraq. I mean, and people are being maimed. This is a national security issue. And so I'm encouraging the president do it. It's the right thing to do. If you don't want to do it because you're African-American and you don't want to lead this conversation, well, then do it in the name of national security.
Or as you said, let Mitt Romney lead the discussion.
Absolutely.
Todd Stump also joins us. Todd, your response.
If you use
you're a little lukewarm to this idea.
If you use the bully pulpit to pitch the same strategies and the same policies that created this mess.
I didn't say that. But
no, I'm not saying if one were to, I apologize, to use the bully pulpit to produce these great society type of programs and gun control and all the rest that created this mess, then it is going to have no effect other than a political one, which may be a good political one. I believe in incentives, right? I think for those young men out there who can choose or at a crossroads or have already been down the wrong path, we need to give them incentives to come back. And that is, if you want to work, if you're a convicted criminal, right, and you want to work your way back into society, we ought to give them a path to get back in there, right? If you complete an education, if you stay off drugs, if you do these things, you can have your voting rights reinstated. You can have you can have your convictions expunged after a certain number of years. Show them that there is a way to be part of society again instead of rejecting society. If that is the message, and if that is accompanied by things like school choice, better policing and more policing, then it's effective.
But what would happen? You know, you've just made a very rational discussion. Mm-hmm. And I think any free-thinking person, regardless of their race, color, creed, wherever they live, I think if you explain to them that, just because you talked about prisoners coming back, if prisoners are just warehouses without some form of education or rehabilitation, the recidivist rate, which is horrible, is only going to get worse.
It's crook school.
It's common sense that you have to be trained when you come back in your community. Mm-hmm. Someone's got to give you a second chance. Congressman Davis in Illinois is the founder of the mm-hmm. or the creator of the Second Chance Act. Mm-hmm. If you cannot see the common sense wisdom of that, then I think, frankly, I think in many cases, and I don't normally throw this word out, you may be racist. You may be racist because you know you don't care about those people. And you, when you say those people, mm-hmm. you mean the blacks who make up a large percentage.
I don't know who those people
are. Of prisons.
But I don't know who the people you to whom you refer are that don't care.
People who cannot or will not admit that you have to connect the dots. In other words, you cannot just send someone to prison, put them there for 3, 5, 6 years, whatever the case may be, and think that they're going to get better. Because in many cases, there is no psychological, there's no education programs, there's nothing going from them. So they go there, they master criminality when they're there, they get out, no one will hire them. What are they supposed to do? They're going to go back to a life of crime. Now you've got to be, frankly, you've got to be an idiot not to be able to draw that line. And what I'm saying is, you're either an idiot or, frankly, you don't care about the people who are trapped in that lifestyle because they happen to have a different color skin than you do. That's what I'm talking about.
But you know,
but though, these are the type of...
But we all agree.
Okay, well, we all agree, but the question is, how can you... And by the way, I do not... I'm not suggesting that a president can run for re-election. Someone said, you know, an election is not a time for education. Mm-hmm. We're talking about deep education here. Mm-hmm. But what I'm saying is there are some quick hit things that a president could do. And that is the thing he can do is he can bring focus to the attention mm-hmm. to an issue.
Sure.
So if he were to come to Chicago and say, you know what, I'm going to spend the next 3 days. I'm going to spend the next 3 days in a state that I know I'm going to win, in a city that I'm going to probably get 75-80% of the vote. And I'm going to come here, not because I think it's good politically, because I'm not wasting my time here. I am coming here to do something morally right. And by doing something morally right, I'm going to hopefully make life better. And you know what? If people around the country say, you know what, that was a good investment of his 3 days, then so be it. Some may think it's a gimmick. Some may say, you know what, I got to give this guy credit because he's really trying to do something. And he could have been in Iowa, New Hampshire.
He can do it full time come January.
Well, that's putting a political spin on it.
Thanks.
Back shortly from Chicago, 1-800-723-8029. And I promise, your calls will be heard next. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Lots of calls. Let's go to Ray listening to us in Woodhull, Illinois. He's listening to us on XM Radio tonight. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's talking about everything but the real cause of this. I mean, look, pass an outright ban on guns. It's not going to do a bit of good. Where are the fathers of these kids when they are growing up? I'll tell you right now, you go out into the gangs and you find out from these gangbangers how many of them even know who their father is. How many of their fathers were around to teach them to be a good man? And after all, that is job number one when a man has a son, is to teach him to be a good man.
Ray, your point about guns, I totally agree with. Your other point, I also agree with. And here's my point. What better person than the President of the United States to talk about what happens when a father's not in the house? And that when the father's not in the house, it isn't 100% of those young boys that go wrong. The president is a shining example of one who did go right, who got on the right track. You may disagree with his politics, but there are millions of young black men in this country who grew up in families without fathers, and you know what? They still got on the right track. But Barack Obama, as president of the United States, is sort of witness number one in explaining that it can be done.
Well, look, I definitely disagree with the president's politics, even though I live in northern Illinois. However, you can't point this.
We ran into a bad phone line. Richard, you were nodding as I was speaking.
Look, I totally agree with you, Bruce. I think that the president can speak to this. He can speak to the fact that, look, it takes a village to raise a child, and it takes a community to embrace children in that community. The president, being from the African-American community, being from a single-parent home where his father was absent, he can speak to it like nobody else can.
Right.
And he should. Let me tell you, Bruce, the other day we saw, and it's happening around the country, 13,000-plus children of illegal immigrants who are actually standing in line to try to get their paperwork, their IDs and stuff, so that they can have this two-year amnesty, if you will, that the president has given via executive order. He did it for the immigrant population, and many will say he did it for political reasons for that vote. Who cares? I don't care about that. I care about the people who are dying in the streets of Chicago, Detroit, Los Angeles, Houston, and other big cities across this country. These are people who can be a part of the American dream, who can live the American dream. They can become tax-paying citizens instead of going to prison, where taxpayers are going to have to pay to foot that bill of $30,000 plus a year, or dying, or being maimed and not being able to go back to work. And so they can't support Medicare. They can't support Social Security. So they become a drag on the society. Everybody in America has to be a part of this American dream and a part of this boat. Right now you have a segment of society, Bruce, that's being totally on an island by themselves.
I think part of the unfortunate reality, and we've shown in about the last half hour how this is an issue we're not talking about in this election, but it's an issue that people certainly who live in large cities see as really a crisis that needs to be addressed. I think the unfortunate reality is that in today's campaign environment, it is not the kind of policy discussion that lends itself to a rational conversation on either side. And what we've seen is the denigration of the rhetoric to take any serious discussion of policy and try to twist that for a 24-hour news cycle advantage. And I think that's really the unfortunate reality.
What needs to be done then is I think there has to be, whether it's a program like this or just talk radio in general or cable television, we have a responsibility, I think, to elevate the debate so that we're not talking about dogs on cars, or we're not talking about what Joe Biden said. We're talking about real important issues.
Okay.
Because the people in the audience out there, the people in the audience, especially if they're in many inner cities of the United States, they're not talking about Medicare. They're worrying about whether they can go down to the grocery store without getting shot, or having their six-year-old granddaughter shot with a bullet through her head because she was sitting in the wrong window at the wrong time because some drive-by gangbanger came by. That's their reality. Absolutely. They're not talking about the Medicare this and 40% of this. They could care less about that.
But an issue you touched on earlier, Bruce, that I want to bring back up is that prisons are big business in this country. Mass incarceration makes a lot of money from municipalities. There's private for-profit prisons. Whenever you have a profit motive, there's going to be somebody there to make that profit. And there's a lot of people, a lot of young black and Latino
unions.
Men.
And unions.
So being
the vast majority of government.
Then put that in. I agree with you.
So,
there is big business. It's not a good idea. It should not be an incentive to meet someone's, bottom line,
sure,
to send people to prison. And the whole, we did a discussion a couple of weeks ago. It hasn't aired yet, but it will in a couple of weeks. And that's the whole issue, the incarceration of America, the over-incarceration.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's absurd what we do in this country with our prison systems.
And it's also used to mask the failing of our political system to really deal with these issues of crime and education.
And our school system.
So go ahead, Tom.
I just wanted to say, the one thing that made this conservative happy on election night in 2008, genuinely, was that we elected an African-American president. And I thought this was an opportunity for a segment of the population that felt alienated from the central culture to say, hey, wait a minute, maybe those people who I don't know, who live out there somewhere, maybe they don't dislike me. Maybe they're not trying to exclude me. Maybe I can be part of this, right? And I thought the president could have encouraged that, and I don't think he did, by saying it's a two-way street, as you said, going down to the community and say, well, I'm part of this culture, I'm part of your culture. I grew up without a father and a mother for much of his life, carted all over the place, raised by his grandparents. He could have been that example, but it's 3 years too late.
But I also want to just clarify that there are many black families with mothers and fathers throughout the country and living in the suburbs, that not every African American lives in the urban environment. So I just want to say that.
Of course.
Let's go to Hector, listening to us in St. Charles on WLS. Go ahead. You're on the air, Hector.
Every speech I've ever heard Barack Obama give, he follows the liberal line. More government. If he came to Chicago, he'd just want more gun control. That's what he would stand for. The exact people who are shooting the place up are the people that he created and the liberalism has created. These are people who are dependent on government. And, less than half the kids who go to high school in Chicago graduate.
Mm-hmm. But again, I don't think you can blame government or government programs for the systemic cultural problems that exist in many inner cities of the United States. You can say,
dependent on government as possible. That is their voting base. The people who are shooting up Chicago are these people. I live west of Chicago. We avoid going there like the plague. We don't go there because we know what's going on.
Sir,
we don't want to be part of it.
At the core of the problems, and by the way, we can agree that an inferior public school education will likely lead you to a less than productive life. We can agree on that. And that there's a government link to it. We might be able to agree that the quality of teachers isn't what it used to be. And maybe it should be. But here's something else. And this is what the teachers say. The teachers are accepting children that are coming from families with either no mother or no father. It's what the greatest classroom in America is, the living room at home.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And we need someone. We need people to start talking about that. Because you know what? When the child is born and the father's already out of the house, going on to someone else to create another child, to go on to another house, that's where the problem exists. We have too many unwanted, unplanned children. We bring them into the world. We forget that there's a responsibility that goes with that. And we need every single leader, and I'm saying starting with the President of the United States, that is a national security issue. Because if you don't address that issue, your school systems are going to be screwed up. Your streets are going to be screwed up. It's going to affect business. It's going to create an over-incarceration of people. It's going to ruin lives, not only the prisoners, it's going to ruin the families of those prisoners. I mean, the ripple effect of the 2.3 million people who are in prison in this United States, think of it, multiply that by five or six. That's what we're talking about in this country. It is a national security issue. But it starts, you know what? If you're going to make a child, it's easy to make a child. You've got to be with that child. There's got to be a responsibility. And that has to be taught, learned, nurtured, and repeated over and over again by all elements of government, all elected officials, ministers of all religions, all teachers. It's a constant, just like the thump-thump beat of a rap music can get into the head of some irresponsible young teenager, that the responsible actions of young people in this country, in the not exclusively in the inner cities. I mean, I'm not saying that there's no illegitimacy in rural white America. There is. And throw in crystal meth there, okay? Got crack cocaine in one area, you got crystal meth in the other. Because irresponsibility, it knows no color line. We need a common denominator of responsibility, and it seems to me that the president, as having the bully pulpit, he's the one. He should be the lecturer in chief. Yep. He should lead the discussion, and he can come right back to his hometown and begin the discussion. I'm Bruce Dumont. Back shortly. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Our Democrats this evening. Our Democrat is Mark Casello. He is an assistant professor of English at St. Joseph College of Calumet. And he also writes for the Huffington Post. And we're going to hear about his most recent post in just a moment. Doug O'Brien also joins us. He was former chief of staff to Illinois Congressman Mark Kirk. And he is the president of Prairie State Strategies. Richard Boykin also joins us. He was across the aisle as chief of staff to Illinois Congressman Danny K. Davis. He is a partner at Barnes and Thornburg, one of the country's leading law firms. Also does a lot of government affairs work for them and is also a minister.
Correct.
And you preach every Sunday?
Not every Sunday, but next week I'm going to be preaching at Congressman Rush's church.
Okay, and your denomination is?
Baptist,
okay. And Todd Stump also joins us. He is a businessman, and also he is with a group called America's Future Foundation. He also was the campaign manager for Dan Proft's campaign, and also was a restaurateur, entrepreneur, and all-around clean-shaven Republican. We've got a
cut. Whoa.
Well, I'm just saying there's a difference between our Republicans tonight. For those listening,
the two wings of the party.
Yeah, for those who are listening to this program on radio, you can't see the close-up of Doug's face. There's a little chin hair on it. We're going to take a couple of calls, and then we're going to move on to some other discussions. But again, we have touched a nerve. Let's head to Alamogordo, New Mexico, where Adam is listening to us on KTSM Radio out of Texas. Go ahead, Adam.
Yeah, thanks. I just wanted to touch on a point made about reducing recidivism. I was convicted in 2003 of violent crime in New Mexico and was released late of 2006. And while incarcerated, they had college classes. I received 58 credit hours. They had fathering programs where I was able to maintain contact with my son and read books to him through audio. And they also had a CDL program where I received my professional driver's license. And since my release in 2006, I've completed probation and parole. And being from New Mexico, once you complete that your parole term, you're able to regain your voting rights also. And all these were tools and incentives that have kept me out of incarceration and has kept the recidivism rate here in New Mexico lower because of those programs. So I just really appreciate you guys touching on that point.
Well, that's very good. But you were incarcerated in New Mexico, you said?
Yes.
Okay.
In state prison.
That's good to hear. And again, in a discussion that we're going to share with you in a couple of weeks, Mark Levin, who is with a group called Right on Crime, they are based in Austin, Texas. This is a conservative group that looks at the actions of the Justice Department and the Bureau of Prisons, and it's a conservative's perspective on the over-incarceration in America. And so it's good to hear that in some states, by the way, some states are doing, they have a pretty remarkable record. In fact, one of the most progressive states, and this may not be something that you would generally think of for those around the country, and that is the state of Texas has some of the most progressive penal reforms in the country. And again, so it's good to hear that that the system is working for some people. It has to work for a lot more. And again, certainly the cost of sending people to prison and the over criminalization is usually tied in to our drug laws, and that's where the vast increase in population is really coming from. And also, thanks very much for your call. Just on that particular subject, one of the things that Congressman Davis is known for in the Chicagoland area, first of all, the congressional district that you were the chief of staff for has more ex-offenders than any congressional district in the United States, the west side of Chicago.
Correct.
And so Danny Davis, the representative of that district, obviously wants to address that issue of getting restarted, and he is the author of the Second Chance Act. President Bush signed it. Talk about that bipartisan relationship that you had, because this is one of those issues, you know, everybody talks about that Republicans and Democrats are sort of at each other's throats in Washington. But in this particular issue, on the issue of incarceration, there has been some very positive signs of cooperation at the congressional level.
Absolutely, and Bruce, I want to appreciate you for bringing this up. The Second Chance Act, obviously signed by President Bush when he was president, authored by Congressman Davis. Senator Rob Portman was also a sponsor of that bill. And it basically addresses all of the needs of someone who's coming out of prison. I mean, they need some assistance right away in terms of health, housing, job training, and that sort of thing. And so it addresses those basic needs. And, you know, obviously we got too many people who are coming out of prisons. We got to figure out a way to, you know.
And we got too many going to prison.
Yeah, we got too many,
people going to prison.
And coming out.
Maybe for the longer than they need to be.
Right.
There's some maybe contemporary ways to deal with those that break laws.
But, you know, one of the things, you know, you cited the numbers, 2.3 million people in prison, nearly 6 million people under the control right now of the criminal the Justice Department in terms of either on probation, parole, or in prison. But then, you know, we have one in three young boys, black boys, who are expected to someday go to prison. We got to reverse that statistic. We got to figure out a way to reverse it.
Well, if you've ever, I don't know if you've ever had a chance to visit a prison, but one of the saddest thing at a visitation is that obviously the inmates are very happy that someone is coming to visit them. But then there are the family reunions that take place. And to watch the children and the wives or husbands of people who, you know, they have their, you know, 1 or 2 hours where they can visit. But to watch those families, so you really get a chance to see the impact that crime and incarceration has on lots of people, because in many cases, these are young boys and young girls who run up to their father dressed in a prison garb, and they cling to their legs and they wait to be hugged. And these are children that are going to be raised in a family without a father. And again, you can say, well, they committed a crime, so they should do the time. Nobody argues that. There's no question that they should do some time. The question is it the right amount? And what can be done to help those? Because if not, you're going to have another generation, potentially of a child, who grows up in a family without a father, or his only recollection of his father is in a prison garb. It's not a happy way. So when you think of that 2.3, just multiply it by about 5 or 6, and that's the sort of the impact of incarceration in the country. Let's go to Eric in Chicago on WLS Radio. Go ahead.
Thank you, Bruce. I love the show.
Thank you.
People in Chicago aren't shooting each other because they think it's jolly good fun. They're fighting over gang territory, which is inextricably linked to the drug war. You're talking about criminalization of people taking intoxicants that the government happens to disapprove of, as opposed to the ones they're fine with. So the drug war is creating problems on two fronts. You have pure consumers who are often sentenced to hard time, thanks to capricious minimum sentencing laws. And you have a government prohibition that grants monopoly power to street gangs in the market for these drugs. So markets work, whether they're black markets or white markets. And you have this prohibition, just as prohibition for alcohol fostered violence in the streets of Chicago once, the prohibition on drugs is fostering violence and chaos here now. So until we take a hard and serious look at the war on drugs and finally bring it to an end, we're never going to address what is really causing the violence on the west and south side of Chicago and in major cities around the country. President Obama can come here and talk till he's blue in the face, but unless he's talking about this policy issue, it's really not going to make a difference.
All right, let's let Todd respond to that. It would be very difficult for any candidate, I think, especially for a Democratic candidate, to talk about legalization. But maybe the discussion needs to be had in a non-presidential year.
I couldn't hear Derek very clearly on the line, but it was I think that was his main thrust.
Right.
We should decriminalize. I think most people would agree it would be useful to decriminalize some drugs. However, I think without a major reform of welfare programs, I think it's going to be a real, real tough sell to tell people that you can take drugs and be covered by a social safety net that you don't have to pay for. I don't think there's any buy-in for that out there. However, I would say that this is a real change among young voters right now. And that is, they are drifting into a libertarian position because they see that the Democratic Party isn't doing some of those things that they are very interested in, and they find the Republican brand toxic. And libertarianism is kind of a safe harbor for them,
right,
where they say, I live in a world of choice, I live in a world of freedom, and neither party is really addressing that, and this is their safe harbor.
Marsh, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say that also, you know, there's a lack of opportunities. These drugs aren't being sold in a vacuum. There's a profit motive there. There's opportunities to make money in that community, to have status, to have power, things that these individuals should be getting from our regular economic system, but they're disenfranchised. They're excluded between the incarceration and their return to the streets. And not to mention this consumption of drugs in the inner city is fueling the violence in Mexico as well. We're all in this together. Internationally, we're a global drug culture, and we have to start it from person to person, from community to community. But we're all in this together.
What are you suggesting, though?
So, education programs, job opportunities, reduce the consumption of drugs by providing people opportunities. People don't do drugs always just for the fun of it. It's often self-therapy. It's often
an escape. You know, there's a long tradition in economically disadvantaged communities of using crime as a way out. It's a way to make money when there are less opportunities. Government stepping in as the panacea to, quote, create job opportunities is not necessarily the way to shift that burden from, from that community onto the taxpayers. I think that Adam, when he talked earlier, had a great story to tell, and we need to applaud that. That's what we've got to be looking at.
1-800-723-8289. Back shortly. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Mark Casello is here. He writes for the Huffington Post, and his latest post is The Unlovables, Mitt and Paul Ryan. Why are they unlovable, your view?
The big point I was trying to make in the article on the Huffington Post was that when you put Barack Obama and Joe Biden side by side to Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan, that I think the average voter is going to find Obama and Biden more charming and lovable. But in particular, I said that Romney, he has sort of an a vulnerability, a fumblingness. His awkwardness is almost endearing, and I bring up the point about the trees being the right height in Michigan and some of these other things he said along the way. So Romney's more lovable, but he lacks sort of an authentic message, so that's going to have his difficulty with connecting. Now, Ryan is likable. You guys on both sides of the aisle here have pointed out that he's a genuine guy. He's who he represents. But with Ryan's Mayberry-style frankness is what I call it, but he has this toxic message. I equated it to that he proposes reforming vital life-changing programs like Social Security and Medicare as if he were delivering a routine colonoscopy. He's just got this almost medicinal frankness that comes across with this message, and that makes him a little bit less.
But some people do like that, don't they? I mean,
First off, you know, the words are strident. The words are extremely bitter and biting, unlovable and toxic. It is this personal character assassination, of course, and that's their stock in trade. But you know, it is all going to this to portraying this venal attempt to injure the American people, put them in chains, throw grandma over the cliff. It is the rhetoric that is damaging the president's, quote, lovability, which I believe he's just singularly flushed down the toilet, and Joe Biden never had any in my book. But the president has completely destroyed his brand, his post-partisan Bringing America Together brand, through his vilification of everybody who doesn't agree with him, his style of politics, and the constant use of this strident rhetoric. And this is just another case in point.
Don?
People like to commonly say they hate politicians, right? I sometimes think politicians must hate us, because they're always told, enough with the slickness and the showbiz. Be yourself. Tell the truth. This week, Romney came out with a whiteboard, and he scribbled a few notes on there and just tried to explain something the way he would explain it. And he was ridiculed up and down for 2 days. And I suppose it was because he just wasn't showbiz enough. I mean, he's got to have had it. But I would also say, from the lovability aspect, I don't need to love my politicians. I'd rather respect them and have confidence in their competence. But in terms of love, and I think this is a major difference in the Republican and Democratic side, right, is, and something that you only find in the case of Reagan on the Republican side, and that is, I have a fidelity to policy, not to personality. And I think you'll find a lot of people on the Democratic side are more likely to have a fidelity to personality.
But the voters that count, those, and I think it's more than just the 5% that decide the election. You will vote for someone that you don't totally agree with, but you will not vote for someone you don't like. So lovability is too strong. Mm-hmm. It's been a long time since I loved a candidate, but you got to like them.
You want to talk
and
about?
So I guess my question to you, I'll ask, this is a Democrat.
We have to like their qualities.
I think this is a particular election
where that's important.
Is there a likability? Do you think that Mitt Romney has a likability problem, Richard?
No, I don't. I think that, Governor Romney is a likable guy. I happen to have met him in person. I mean, he was very, very nice guy. I heard him speak. And one of the things about him is that he seems almost too perfect, though. I mean, that's the thing. But I think, you know, with Congressman Paul Ryan, whom I met in person, too, I mean, he's very likable. He's a ordinary straight guy. And so I think ultimately the election, Bruce, comes down to, you know, the best leader for the country and the direction that the country is going to go in.
The political community is going to be focused on Tampa, Florida for the Republican convention. Coming up, we're on the verge of that. Doug, what do you want to – if you were to give one piece of advice to Romney for his speech, or the staging that he obviously is choreographing, what would it be? What do you want the people home watching TV to see out of Tampa next week?
You touched on it. I think he needs to show a good deal of his personal side, as does Paul Ryan, and I think that there will be a tremendous advantage to that. But I think most importantly, avoid the stridency, and to really be able to give a cogent outline of how they're going to govern the country differently. The independent voters who are key in this race have turned away from the Obama administration. You see the numbers tanking there, and it's an opportunity to show them a different vision, not to berate their opponents and attack them. That's not going to appeal to the key voters.
What do you want to see?
The Democrats are going to have a fantastic convention because they're bringing out actual genuine people who have been affected positively by Obama's policies. The Republicans need to do the same to show how their policies are not just abstract, how they affect real people in a moral sense. And they need to do that and illustrate that very strongly.
So all the VIP speakers, Romney and Rubio or Chris Christie, he's going to be the keynote speaker. I mean, is he going to – I can't imagine him being soft and cuddly.
It's not a matter of soft and cuddly. It's a matter of pointing out – why the policies, what effect it has on a real person's life. That's not soft.
It's the economy, stupid. I just came up with that all by myself.
Write that down. It's a good line.
But I think he makes a good
point. On that note, we want to say farewell to our Democrats, Mark Casello and Richard Boykin, and to our Republicans, Todd Stemp and Doug O'Brien, for being with us on this edition of Beyond the Beltway. This program is a Genevieve production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio in Chicago. Thanks to Tom Veracruz and Dan Dorfman for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.